decisions.
So now that everyone's been able to join in the conversation, I want to keep us on this ethical lens because we are on the ethical track, and I appreciated, Lisa, you mentioning it at the outset. And I'm going to try to go down two paths, and we'll see how long they take. Maybe we'll only make our way down one. Ken, I'm very drawn to your final, your most recent comment about the limitations of sort of clunky valuation metrics, the notion that once you disaggregate a population, you may find a subset of the population where the effects are quite large. The majority, it's quite small. If you do some sort of averaging, it looks like something is of low value. And certainly if you want to promote discovery and advancement, we need to invest the capital. But from the ethical question, I wonder, is sort of the, again, a little bit of where we started, which is somewhere someone's paying for that advance. It's either built into their insurance premium, it's built into their taxes. We've heard stories of people who are struggling to afford the basics. And so I guess the ethical question is, even if those valuation formulas or calculations are somewhat rough, it's seems to me it's pretty hard to deny that we are imposing upon people, either through taxes or premiums, the requirement that they contribute to the development of these products where the yield is probably less than paying than what they would get if they were covering their rent. So I just wonder if we could talk a little bit about the trade-off in the ethics of advancing medicine, which is something we all want to do, but also taking into account the pinch that it places on people. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think I actually think what you're sort of asking is the pricing versus access debate, and I think you actually have to tie those two things together. And I think that most people don't really understand what's going on and why price and access are actually the same issue. And actually, I think that the U.S. system has an opportunity to leapfrog what's going on. I don't think the system's perfect in Europe either or in other parts of the world where the way pricing happens is actually restricting access. So effectively, just sort of, you know, with the way that it works in the U.S., it's also the way that it works in Europe, the payers, whether they're countries or whether they're insurance companies, essentially pit Pfizer versus Merck against each other. And they say, we're going to give you access, we're going to give you a lower tier on the formulary to our population of patients, whoever gives us a lower price on those medications. And there's a war that goes on. And in some insurance plans, it's Lipitor that gets on the formulary. And in other insurance plans, it's Zocor that gets on the formulary. And they do this, they're able to do this more effectively actually in Europe than they are in the US because there's only a single payer. And so they're able to negotiate even lower discounts. But at the end of the day, that's actually a terrible system for patients, because we have overwhelming evidence today that different patients respond differently to different medications. There are some patients who should be on Zocor. There are other patients who should be on Lipitor. And so if you even negotiated a 50% decrease in the price of that medication, Lipitor versus Zocor, the amount of expense that you're going to cause the system by having the patient on the wrong medication actually doesn't work. So a lot of the debate today is about basically whether it's a return on investment model or whether it's a value-based medicine model. We're basically talking about regulating pricing. Every time you regulate pricing, you know, you basically destroy innovation in some way, shape, or form, and there's a winner and a loser. And the reality here is that right now, the people who are losing the most are patients, because they're either overpaying for their medications or the medications that they want are not on their formulary, they're just not available to them. And so I think what actually has to happen is we have to create a system where the pie can grow for everyone, because the only way that we're going to get change is that the pharma companies actually have to get bigger. They're going to only give up things and work collaboratively if they can actually generate more sales. And at the same time, we have to figure out ways of taking those benefits and giving them to patients and to health systems in ways that the whole pie gets bigger, as opposed to Zeke arguing that, you know, we need to lower prices and basically make sure prices are lower so that pharma companies make less money or so that providers
don't attribute a view I didn't say. First of all, I said that there's some drugs are underpriced. And I've said this publicly. I've written about it. They are underpriced. Their value is much more than we are willing to pay. Almost every vaccine fits that bill. They prevent us from getting an illness, and we are unwilling to pay a lot of money for them. They're almost all underpriced. I am saying what we should pay for is the common sense notion: I pay more for something that really improves my health, and I pay less for something that doesn't really improve my health. That seems to me pretty common.
But who's
going to
make that judgment? But who's going to make that judgment?
I'll tell you. We have.
I'm curious.
First of all, we have a system, and unlike what Ken and Kirsten said, I said And I acknowledge, right at the start, when a drug hits the market, we have the least data we have. But we have to make an assessment as to what the price is. Guess what? Pfizer makes that assessment of to what price it wants to charge. J&J does. Merck does. We make an assessment. And then I said we come back 3 years later when we have better data. Sometimes that data does show it's really effective in some small population, and overall, it's worthless, right? We have those kind of data. Avastin is a case, the drug for that was used for metastatic breast cancer, right? And then you change what you're going to price it at because it has either shown to be more valuable or just the same value or less valuable. You make that assessment over and over again. I don't see any other way of making a objective, coherent assessment of what the benefit is to the price. If you want to tell me we have no way of assessing the benefit of our interventions, then we're all sunk. Then there's no grounded way of deciding whether we should pay $100,000 for a drug or $5 for a drug.
You're listening to Aspen Public Radio, and we are broadcasting a live talk from the Aspen Ideas Festival regarding the cost of pharmaceutical drugs.
You talk to health plans, you talk to patients, and you talk about the attributes of the drug that you know at that point. And you ask what a reasonable price would be. You also look at other things on the market that are treating that same condition, whether it's surgery or something else. If it's something like a vaccine that has a very broad population, you also think about the impact on the insurance premium and the impact on the budget for the state. So you don't price that drug to reflect its value. So there is an affordability constraint. You also think about things like your patient assistance programs. Pfizer recently expanded their patient assistance to 400% of the federal poverty level. That's about $100,000 for a family of four to address exactly the problems that Lisa's been raising. So all those things go into it. If you want one central assessor of value, that's one central entity that has other pressures on them, political pressures, budget pressures, and then you end up in a different game. There's lower prices in Europe and other countries as single payers for everything, doctors' fees, hospitals, drugs. You get lower prices by excluding certain providers.
Let's just be clear for a second. In the American healthcare system, hospital prices are actually regulated. Right, Ken?
Yes.
Who determines your Medicare price?
62% of what we do is determined by the feds.
Okay. Doctors, who determines how much an office visit? The feds do. Let's take drugs. They have a monopoly guaranteed to them by the federal government, right, through patents and FDA exclusivity. And who helps determine their prices?
Nobody.
Nobody. Okay? It's not the way the system works.
But that's absolutely not correct. The health plans do exactly the same kind of value assessment that the NHS does or anybody else, and they have millions of lives in them. So it's not a system where you're just putting a price out there. If it were, the prices would be higher. It's a system where you're negotiating and you have other people on the other side of the table
Sovaldi
looking at the
did not look at the affordability to Medicaid. It didn't look at the affordability to jails.
The price
so
came
what I
down
think, 50%. I mean, we're having two different conversations here. I mean, one is what does the public payer do? And the other is what does the private market look like? And you're emphasizing appropriately the dynamics of the private market. Zeke, you're emphasizing the limitations of what the government's role is in setting prices in pharmacy relative to other services. So I'm not sure that I just think you're looking at different parts of the puzzle here.
You know, I have to jump in and say, you know, Ken said something earlier that was fantastic, and he talked about the social contract and how we have just completely lost sight of it. And these discussions, I think, are an effort. I think everyone is trying to sort of redefine what that social contract is. And part of it that I wanted to say a while ago was that, you know, taxpayers get hit two times. So with somebody like Marlene gets hit with a high price, no protections, but her tax dollars have actually gone about, you know, a healthy percentage goes toward the basic science research that drug companies and other companies use. So you get hit in both ways.
Well, wait a second. Also a third time. She pays
for
Medicare and Medicaid,
exactly right.
And they have to pay the drug bill.
Exactly.
So I want to bring in another social contract element. There is this program called 340B, which is designed to provide access to lower-cost drugs for safety net institutions. Kia, a lot of your clients or your provider systems are part of that. Why doesn't that, as part of the social contract, solve the problem?
So as you've heard across the board, the healthcare system is very fragmented. To suggest that one program, be it corporate patient assistance programs or federal 340B drug pricing, which is a program that's meant to lower the costs of purchasing prescription drugs at federally qualified health centers and nonprofit clinics, to suggest that just one program, that we are anywhere in the realm of a place where one program will meet all of these different fragmented needs in areas, I think is just not realistic. So that's a great program for some federally qualified health centers who have, on-site pharmacies or contract pharmacies to help reduce the price of drugs for them to receive. However, you do end up with these super messy issues of it doesn't always include every drug. Or when you have an exorbitant price hike in generics, that's also reflected in that area. So I think one of the advantages of our model and trying to redistribute what's already out there is our costs of procuring medicine have nothing to do with what the costs were assessed or the value assessed by the pharmaceutical company or the hospital that purchased it or the nursing home, et cetera. So it's this really interesting model where us getting the drugs is not impacted by their market value. And thus, what we're able to do is then take those drugs and say, great, we need to make sure that we get all of these drugs to the right patient at a price point that they can afford. And we need to create the system that is more transparent in drug pricing so that people know what they're going to get. You would never buy a car and then 6 months later get a bill for it. So why are we expecting people to do the same with their health care? And I think 340B is a great example of one way that the federal government has tried to step in and stabilize some drug pricing for community health centers that are doing good work, but it doesn't include every drug. They still see the same issues of pricing hikes for very old generics or for branded, and in some cases it doesn't actually include all the drugs.
It's also abused, too. This 340B is notoriously abused by hospital systems.
Why don't you expand on that?
Well, this is not an area we've looked deeply into, but you can see that in some cases those medications, while the hospital may be able to obtain them at a tremendous discount, those discounts they're not often passed on to people with commercial insurance. They're actually sold at the regular price. And so you have a person who is like a taxpayer who's already paid for this discounting to happen and is paying full price back on top of it.
To explain a little bit, so there is this whole issue of part of the way that program was set up was, hey, we'll give you discounted pricing, and if you have commercial payer clients in, charge them that price. And then the idea is some sort of like trickle down. So you're going to make money from commercially insured, and then you should pass on that savings to low-income people.
Right, it's the same concept.
It also isn't a regulated space where it says, okay, if you made a profit, X hospital, you must give this medication for free to a patient.
Right.
You're right.
And it's the same, it's the same concept too. Is, Kirsten mentioned earlier about discounts that happen in the industry side of things, but these discounts never make their way toward a consumer. The discount may go to an insurance company or an employer, but a consumer doesn't, I don't feel the rebate necessarily, from so many pills being sold.
Well, part of what's going on there is what I described early on is, the plans are under a medical loss ratio. They have to pass on the rebates, but they pass them on to the premium. They pass them on to what you pay each month, rather than passing them on to the copay for the medicine. And so they are getting to the consumers, but they're not getting to the consumers for the medicine. So if you're the person who has a rare disease or has rheumatoid arthritis, you go and you experience that very high cost sharing for your condition. So it's the people who are the sickest who are getting the least benefit from those discounts. And that's where the point that I raised earlier, I think we have to figure out how to get the tools in the hands of the plans and all of the healthcare system so that the incentives are in the right place. So if you've failed on the cheaper medicine, if you've taken a generic and you failed on a generic, you should be allowed to get the branded medicine at a lower copay or whatever it is that you need.
I don't think those systems are in place for pharmacy benefit managers. That's the other. I think there's for certain kinds.
Okay.
Right.
So
that isn't. I don't want to take us too far away, but that is.
Jeff, go into that, and I want to get back a little bit to the value, but.
The issue is that we have this very blunt instrument today where it's a one-size-fits-all formulary. It's a one-size-fits-all system. Either your whole population gets access to a medication or it doesn't. And the reality is as you just said, there should be smart step therapy. But if your insurance company today mails you your claim 2 or 3 weeks later, they have no way of communicating with you. Your pharmaceutical company has no idea who you are. You actually may be willing to give a patient a discount, but if you don't know who they are, have an ability to communicate with them or deliver them money, how can you do it? And so that is the role of technology, and I think we're going to see that. That's what we're working on. We're going to see it very quickly, where you can facilitate these transfers of value between people who want to do it, and we can start the patient on a generic medication first, Once we realize that that's not the appropriate medication for them, we can move them to a branded medication. We can allow Pfizer actually to deliver money to that patient and give that drug for the patient for free if that's something that they wish. And by the way, so everyone should download the Blink app. And if you enter the code ASPEN, everyone in here got $20 off their next medication. But that's the type of thing that.
How much did you pay for that advertisement?
Nothing. Whoever uses it. But the basic point is that we're able to do that with technology today. That it's more of to demonstrate something that I could create that coupon or offer and give it to a patient to get them to do a specific behavior. But so could Pfizer, so could Mount Sinai, so could the government if they wanted to. And that's the type of smart directing, smart pricing that you're now able to do with technology.
So I want to have a little bit more conversation about value, tee up hopefully you'll handle it quickly, and because I want to make sure the folks in the room get into the conversation. So, you know, we've had this nice conversation about value, and Kirsten, you said we do price on value. Now, from a public policy perspective, we have proposals to change how the federal government procures in Part B, and it didn't exactly meet with great enthusiasm. And it was called value, it was designed to promote payment on the basis of value. So I wonder if, and Ken, I know you've given some thought to this too, I wonder if the two of you could reflect on sort of what the difference is between what's been proposed and the concept that you said that the industry actually supports. Well,
you know, what's ironic about the question that you ask is, when I choose what drugs will be on the Mount Sinai formulary for the 37,000 employees we have, I can bargain. I mean, I can say I don't want that drug because it's essentially a branded drug and we have an equivalent generic. So we're just not going to have it. Two cases in point. I mean, people should just, I think, really understand these issues. When Nexium came out, the purple pill. So the purple pill is just the L form of Prilosec. Right. Mm-hmm. So these racemic mixtures, this may be complicated chemistry, but suffice it to say that this is just a way of getting around a patent with some simple chemistry that made the purple pill sound like was something special. Now, if I'm running the formulary, what I say is, we're not gonna have Nexium on the formulary, end of story, because Prilosec is generic now, we're just gonna buy that. Medicare can't say that. Medicare's gotta take it on. And then doctors are detailed by the pharmaceutical companies, and they're somehow made to believe that the purple pill's better. The same thing happened with Celexa and Lexapro. And they were detailed like crazy, and being a psychiatrist, I know all the misstatements that were made about the L form, about Lexapro versus Celexa. But we won't allow our Medicare formulary to have the same kind of flexibility that we have when we manage our formulary.
So I guess I could address the Medicare drugs that are used in the hospital or physician's office or the Medicare formulary point that you just raised. I mean, the Medicare formularies for the drugs that are in pharmacies, retail drugs, are determined by health plans, and they do exclude drugs, and that's how they get discounts. Unlike a system outside of the U.S. where there's only one formulary, if your drug is not available on your health plan, then you can switch health plans the next year. And you try to. And there's actually very good tools. Talking about transparency, there's a very good drug finder tool that you can look and you can go on and look and you can see not just what the drug costs, but what your copay is when you're making your decision about what plan to go into. And that's part of why the Medicare Part D program has gotten good satisfaction ratings from seniors for a number of years. Now, the drugs that are dispensed in the doctor's office and in the hospital, and you raised the pilot, so do you want me to, I mean, I can respond to that a little bit, and I know Zeke spoke to it as well. The issue there is that the government's proposed reducing the amount of money that goes to the doctor for that drug. It used to be that doctors would get the sales price of the drug plus what's effectively now 4%, and they're proposing reducing that to 2%. Concern, and it's a big pilot, and again, concern that both physicians and pharmaceutical companies have raised is what would that mean for access to oncologists who were using that money to sustain their practice. Basically, that's how part of the way they do medication management and see those patients. It's a fee for distributing the medicine. Should their fee be tied to the price of the medicine? No, that's not a great system. But the concern with this very big pilot is that to go
very quickly to that would cause a disruption in access. And what many have asked for is that there's appropriate safeguards put in place and appropriate studies be put in place, and this pilot be scaled up on a smaller basis so you can see what this kind of change would mean for patients and their access to physicians.
You didn't describe the change accurately, okay? The way Medicare pays for things like oncology drugs, multiple sclerosis drugs, is they take the average sales price of the last quarter, and they then say to the doctor, you get that average sales price plus 6% for administering it. So if you are prescribing a drug that's $10,000 in the month, you get $10,000 and $600 for prescribing it. By giving a percentage, you are incentivizing the doctor to prescribe more expensive drugs when there are two drugs of clinical that are clinically equivalent. It's just like paying a commission to a car salesman who then has an incentive to sell you a more expensive car. So doctors have a financial incentive to prescribe more expensive drugs. There is very good data out there that doctors surprisingly respond to financial incentives and switch their prescription to more expensive drugs. We have the data in oncology, my area, around lung cancer in particular. The proposal by Medicare is the following. Because the average sales price across the country is not the same number, there's some fluctuation in it, we're going to give you the average sales price plus 2.5%, and then we're going to give a flat fee, $16, $17. Now, it turns out it's not less money for every drug. It's more money for all drugs up to $450 or so dollars, but it turns out to be a flat fee above that. So the difference between prescribing a $100 drug and a $10,000 drug goes away. And you then decide whether the $100 drug or the $10,000 drug for the same condition, when they're clinically equivalent, which one to prescribe. That was part one. Part two is, then we should actually change what the patient sees. The patient, if they're getting a value-based drug, ought to see no copay. And let's see how that works. There is no reason to say suddenly doctors won't be able to prescribe drugs. All the drugs are still on the formulary. What doctors won't be able to do is get more reimbursement for prescribing a more expensive drugs. Doctors shouldn't be getting that reimbursement. They should decide what to prescribe on the basis of whether it works for the patient or doesn't work for the patient, not what they're going to get because they prescribe a more expensive drug. That's the basis of this. Now, what has happened? Oncologists who make more money when they prescribe more expensive drugs screamed. Patient advocacy groups, paid for by many of them having significant contributions from the drug companies, screamed, we're going to be denied drugs. This proposal doesn't deny anyone any drug. It just takes away the financial incentive to prescribe more expensive drugs. Why is CMS doing it? It doesn't have any other tools, no other tools to try to affect the drug pricing issue. And the American public wants the drug pricing issue addressed. That's the bottom line. And I think it's a, you know, is it the most ideal solution? I don't think so. I don't think there's anybody in the country, including Medicare, who thinks it's the ideal solution. But it's what they have, the tools they have available.
Actually, you are right about one thing, you know, about...
Only one thing?
About 75% of Americans that we spoke to in our nationally representative poll said they want government action of some kind to salt shore up this problem. And that is definitely...
So just quickly, what's interesting, you know, we work mostly in the outpatient setting, but what's interesting is there is actually a lot of regulation on the outpatient setting to kind of combat this very thing. So for example, Stark Law says you can't be a doctor and own a pharmacy. Why? Because then you end up in this super weird, you know, of course people are going to start prescribing things that then their pharmacy will make more money on. So I do think there is this, it's super interesting that we have some of these in place in some parts of the government and in some parts of healthcare where we're saying there's this clear, you know,
conflict of interest.
Like, we need to address this. We need to not pay prescribers to give some certain medications. There was also a recent article looking at copay foundations, which are, you know, these organizations that are largely funded by pharmaceuticals that help basically distribute money out to individuals who can't afford their copay for certain drugs. There are these clear kind of conflicts of interest here where when you're paying someone to take a drug or paying someone to prescribe a drug, you end up with this very messy system that we're currently in. So it's just interesting because on the outpatient setting, I do see that we have some of these factors in place that alleviate this concern.
I just want to point out one thing about sort of the regulatory complexity and sort of the regulatory solution to the problem, and just point out how some of the regulation. I think regulation is definitely a part of the solution, but it's also created a lot of the problems, and so those are things that we have to recognize. And I'll just give you one example. So if we talk about what's going on actually with generic medications, the generic suppliers are all the same. So they've merged globally, and there's one, basically there are a few big purchasers of those generic medications. And everywhere outside the United States, we've had actually generic deflation, which makes sense. It's a commodity, the prices should decline. In the US, for consumers, you've had generic inflation, and it's been substantial. And so the question is, like, how is that happening when the same companies are purchasing this and they're selling it outside the United States for less money? So it's not actually so much an issue that the FDA hasn't approved these things. Like, they have access to it. Well, what's actually happening is that there are these crazy things called PBMs, which most people don't understand, called pharmacy benefit managers. And the pharmacy benefit managers, there was a conflict about 15 years ago where Merck sort of founded the first pharmacy benefit manager called Medco. And what they're supposed to do is they work on behalf of insurance companies to negotiate prices on drugs for the clients of those insurance companies. Well, it's a little bit of a conflict if Merck owns the company that's supposed to negotiate those prices. So the government basically mandated that Merck divest Medco and said this has to be an independent company. But then, a few years later, and so for branded medications, they actually sort of work in a more functional way. They don't have a conflict. A few years later, the government actually said, "You, pharmacy benefit manager, you can merge with a pharmacy." Mm-hmm. And so now you have the two largest, the company that's supposed to manage your drug spend, one of their two largest ones. One's Express Scripts, the other one's Caremark. Caremark owns CVS. So if you want to know why your drug prices are increasing, the people who are supposed to be causing the prices to decline actually own the pharmacy. And so you can actually look. These are public companies. We can look at what's happened to their profitability per script, and they go up and up and up every year. There's a conflict of interest. The same thing, Express Scripts is the second, is the first largest PBM. They actually make two-thirds of their profitability from their mail order pharmacy. So, but these were things that the government actually mandated. They allowed this to happen. So, and it was they pointed to a study that showed that mail order was a very effective way of keeping people adherent to their medications. And because of that, we created a system where you now have massive generic inflation in the US. So, you know, none of these solutions, there is no easy solution to these problems, and I don't think it's government, it's not only technology, it's going to be some collaboration of all of these forces working together, figuring out ways that everyone can win, but it is crazy, actually, what's going on.
So I need to get the room in. I'm going to ask a question, simple question. Jeff, your scenario, three of you walk in, buy the same loaf of bread that cost $1 to produce. You'd just been laid off, you had the highest price. Globally, from an ethical perspective, we're actually, and we had a very, this is very U.S. pricing focused, but there was, we are very comfortable with the notion that as the first world, as the richest country, we need to subsidize drug creation and pay higher prices so that people can live, just have, you know, truly life-saving drugs in the rest of the world. My question is, when you came up with that scenario, you gave the highest price to the person who'd just been laid off. But if we had the scenario where the lowest price was to the person that Lisa described at the beginning, who's trading off between rent and drugs, would we feel more ethically comfortable? And is that sort of what we should aspire to? Or should we aspire to a market level where you walk into the grocery store and a loaf of bread is the same price for everybody?
I have to say, I think we have to ascribe to transparency. And so Jeffrey's point earlier that, you know, that everybody knows what the price is. And that is not just consumers. That goes to employers. That goes to government, all payers. Because part of the problem is there's no explanation of benefits when you fill out a prescription. There's no way of knowing really how much everybody's getting paid. And part of it is the pharmacy benefit managers like Express Scripts and CVS Caremark. There is nothing that forces them to show where all this money goes. And that is to me one of the greatest problems. The other part, you mentioned a minute ago, is there's also no requirement that they act as a fiduciary. They do not have to act on behalf of their clients. They can act on their own behalf.
Ellen, I would take your ethical thing. I think we do want, actually, a fair price that is the same price for everyone. And what we want to do is subsidize people who have lower income in other ways, like subsidize their purchase of insurance or subsidize reducing their co-pays and things like that. I don't think you want to have
One of the problems of the pharmacy price system, as I think was well pointed out, is it's a total black box, and prices are all over. You have list price, you have the discounted price. None of us know really what that is. We infer it from lots of information in the marketplace, but it's a total black box. I think we would like to have a transparent price and subsidize people who are lower income in other ways to get their health insurance. I think that would be a much fairer system.
But there, I mean, that's exactly what the Affordable Care Act was intended to do, subsidize people who have lower income, and whether it's their co-pays or their premiums. The transparency point is one that we need to do better. We need to make it very easy when you're buying an insurance plan that you can see what your drugs cost, what your hospitalization is going to cost you, what your primary care will cost you, what cancer centers are available to you, so that people really can shop around and get the right product that's right for them.
What about seeing what our drug prices really are?
The list prices for drugs are published. They are publicly available for anybody.
And then you argue, list prices are not real.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but so this whole issue of like the list price, the retail prices, it is, I think, unconscionable that if you're a low-income person, you walk into a pharmacy and you get what's called the usual and customary price, which is like a retail price. No one paid, but if you have insurance, you would never pay
that
amount. No one would pay that. And it's even interesting, like coupon programs or organizations like Blink that are basically just adding on existing coupons to that retail price just to bring it lower. It's like going into, I go to a car wash, that there's a coupon bin right next to the cash register that gives you $5 off. Right. So literally the fact that we have to have services that are like reaching a coupon, taking it out and giving it to the cashier, like this is silly. Awesome. You're the only one who has to pay that price. I've even heard stories of people who know their insurance is canceled. They give their insurance card number at the hospital or at the doctor's office, and then the person comes back and says, "Oh, wait, sorry, your insurance is covered. It's canceled, but we're still going to give you that lower price because we're not going to give you the regular pricing." I mean, that's what's really unconscionable at this system, is that if you're low income, you're paying the price that no one else is paying.
Right. I just want to point out, so just one thing to clarify. So just so people know, Blink is not a coupon service. So what basically Blink is doing, so the way that Blink works.
It's a voucher service. There's not much difference.
It just relates to, because we are actually a fiduciary of users. So what we're doing is these prices do exist already, which is the whole point, and we're giving everyone access to those insured company prices. Right, and we actually do sign, when you join, you do sign a fiduciary. We become a fiduciary of our members so that we can't make money unless basically they're saving
money. Well, how come everybody can't do that? That's my
question. Well, the two most important parts are really transparency and then ensuring stability for low-income people.
All right. Can we focus there, Ken?
So. I think Zeke put it very well. I mean, we would like to have a fixed price, but then we have to make it affordable, and we have to do that with subsidies or other mechanisms. But Alan, when you started, one of the points that you made is we're all comfortable with the notion that the U.S. will pay for drug discovery and drug development, and we're going to be beneficiaries to the rest of the world. And the point that I want to make is I think that's not true for the Western world. I think the Western world has to now start to contribute to the costs, and they can't just keep their prices 50% or 25% of what it is in the U.S. so that American consumers wind up overpaying for drugs to support the R&D effort that we need that's so essential.